the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning, and welcome to A View From Afar. And today, we've got a big program here, and we're going to be enjoyed, but also joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan, and we're going to be analysing. With the United States being viewed as responsible for a monumental botch-up in Afghanistan, how should its traditional security partners, including NATO and Australia, position for that future? For example, why should the United States of America's global security partners in both northern and southern hemispheres view the United States as a reliable security leader? When we consider the United States-led conflicts in Libya, in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, there is a pattern that stands out. There are all these wars that seem to come under the category of wars of opportunity or choice, rather than wars of necessity. And in analysing this, it follows that lessons learnt by NATO and other global security partners may very well be to not follow the US into such conflicts if existential threats do not exist. Also today, Paul and I are going to consider this. Are the United States' failures tied solely to incompetent leadership, or is this clearly an apparent incompetence caused by those within the star general ranks of the Occupational Forces Command, or is this problem institutionalized within a morphed alliance of incompetence from a broad base of institutions located within the United States' security defense apparatus? Now, the United States is shifting its global defence strategy from the north to the southern hemispheres, but also most significantly to counter the rise of China, for example, in the Western Pacific and the Indo-Pacific regions. Now, should these states and economies of the Asia-Pacific fall behind the United States once again and risk being drawn into another unnecessary and protracted war? And considering the United States' domestic situation, and this is a big one, the situation in the United States domestically is insecure and democratically chaotic. Should the United States lead the rest of the world from the front, or should it take a lead from the rear type of position if it is going to be a global superpower that leads Western nations? So you can see there's a lot to unpack in this program. Let's cross to Paul now, who is waiting online to discuss these issues and a lot more. We're going to Paul now. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good, Selwyn. I'm sure glad that you phrased your introduction as a series of questions, because otherwise you wouldn't need me here.
You wouldn't need a lot of it. Obviously, has come from our preparing for this episode. We just don't do it on the fly, do we? And you know, to get an episode like this out, it takes a lot of things. So a lot of that work was obviously Paul's, not mine. But Paul, if we're looking at Tanakwe and Kapai to all of that, Paul, if let's take a look at for example this element that is at the forefront of our questions today. And that is, with the United States pull out from Afghanistan, it has many wondering, for example, whether or not it is and remains a reliable security partner. Can you take us through this element in the first instance, Paul?
Yeah, and I'll refer our viewers and listeners to an episode a couple of weeks ago where one of our regular listeners asked the question, is the U.S. a reliable security partner for Taiwan and the Ukraine? And at the time, I said, well, we're talking apples and oranges. Afghanistan is very different from those two states. But I've been thinking about that since then, and I'd like to modify what I had to say with a twist. So I'm not completely repudiating what I said before, but here's the twist. The United States is going to continue to act as if it's a reliable security partner. It's going to talk the talk. And that talk will include, from time to time, asking its allies and other erstwhile coalition partners to enter into conflict theaters, enter into military ventures that the United States doesn't want to do alone, perhaps for diplomatic cover, perhaps because it feels a bit stretched. But nevertheless, the U.S. will continue to act as if nothing happened, nothing to see here. Our guarantee is good. And I would say, no, something has changed dramatically. And that is to say, allies and partners of the United States need to think long and hard before they agree to any such coalitional venture with the United States in the near to medium term future. And the reason for that is both domestic to the United States and then, of course, international in nature. You said it. The U.S. entered into a series of conflicts after 9/11 in places that posed no existential threat to U.S. interests. Sure, Al-Qaeda had to be dealt with in Afghanistan, and the Taliban needed to be punished for hosting Al-Qaeda, but that job was done by April 2002. Everything after that, the invasion of Iraq, the attempt at regime change in Libya, all of that was by choice. It was opportunistic. And quite frankly, to my mind, and yes, with the benefit of hindsight, no partners should have joined the United States in those ventures, no matter how much pressure the U.S. put on them. And that includes New Zealand as well as Australia. Mm. The abject collapse of the Western-backed Afghan government, and then the calamitous retreat out of Kabul should serve as fair warning to any would-be partner of the United States that the U.S. gets itself entangled in these things, and need I hark back to Vietnam, another war where the U.S. left in retreat, and consider their own strategic interests, consider their own existential threats, which may or may not be coterminous with those of the United States. So I think the big lesson here is not so much that the United States will you know, continue to offer security guarantees and will talk as if it still is the sole superpower on Earth, but whether or not allies of the U.S. can afford to follow it into the seemingly endless and certainly futile wars of opportunity that ultimately end in, if not defeat, certainly in retreat.
You know, and this raises a big question, you know, from the Asia-Pacific region, certainly the Western Pacific areas, Australasia, for example. In this region, there are probably, I can't think of a more staunch, friendly, uncompromised, committed ally of the United States beyond Australia. And if we just go to this clip here, I'll just bring it up, Paul. It's ABC in Australia talking exactly on this point. I'll just bring it up on screen as soon as we get our connections going here. Here we go. And this is Australia, remember.
Not in anger, but in jubilation. The Taliban had its capital and its country back. The last US C-17 transporter just roared into Kabul's night.
Tonight's withdrawal signifies both the end of the military component of the evacuation, but also the end of the nearly 20-year mission that began in Afghanistan shortly after September 11th, 2001.
And if we just move forward from this element here and try to pick up exactly what the ABC is talking about with respect to this whole commitment to the United States.
With us.
I'm having a bit of a connection problem here. I'll come back to that. But what I'm talking about here, Paul, The military alliance, for example, let the United States and Australia through ANZUS. And it's interesting that they still have the NZ part in the ANZUS Treaty or Security Alliance that is running here. And the ABC is noting that the celebrations of 70 years of ANZUS is in existence. So we've got a better connection now. I'll just let this part run.
Trump in a 2019 visit.
Australia's not a difficult relationship for the US, but the danger of that is that both sides can take each other for granted.
So when the 45th US president decided to end the war in Afghanistan and his successor Joe Biden named the exit date, Australia wasn't consulted.
And as we bring an end to 20 years of military conflict in Afghanistan, Australia is still standing with the United States.
Yet President Biden hasn't spoken to the Prime Minister since the chaotic and tragic withdrawal.
I was surprised at the lack of consultation, particularly given that Australia had been part of the commitment to Afghanistan for a very long time.
John Howard, who was in Washington at the time of the September 11 terrorist attacks, invoked the ANZUS Treaty to join the fight against Al-Qaeda.
Barbarism has no ethnicity and evil has no religion.
That treaty turned 70 today, commemorated by wreath-laying in Canberra.
Through the years, Australians and Americans have built an unsurpassed partnership and an easy mateship, grounded in shared values and shared vision.
Together we share hope, we share burden, and we share vision.
Shared vision may be, but the US-Australia relationship is an unequal one. America's attention distracted by a renegotiation of the global order.
Now, Paul, sorry to interrupt your flow there, but it was quite relevant, I thought, that Australia's ABC, or Australian Broadcasting Corporation, was actually covering exactly this point. It is one of the first times I have seen a significant mainstream media in Australia actually starting to criticise the bedrock of the ANZUS alliance and actually framing that in its front end and suggesting that is the alliance stable on the basis of what has occurred in Afghanistan, of Australia being excluded from having the president talk directly to it, and also from the point of view of where the United States seems to be positioning, and Australia up until recent months, positioning very willingly as an adversary of the People's Republic of China. So those points, I thought, were accentuated by what you were talking about. And Paul, what do you make of that change in temperature and that change in and critique of its own foreign policy on Australian soil there?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between the much broader strategic objectives of the Australian foreign policy elite versus the specificities of individual conflicts and the coalition politics that go with them. And by broader issues, I mean this. The Australians clearly want to be the U.S.'s deputy sheriff in the Southern Hemisphere. So that's the long-term picture. And so they will follow the United States into futile wars of opportunity because it isn't about the conflict itself. It's about the broader relationship where the United States feels comfortable that the Australians will follow them anywhere. And perhaps the Australian foreign policy elite, to include both of the major parties or coalitions of parties, believe that to be true, believe that their strategic interests are those of the United States. And certainly when it comes to the People's Republic of China, they do overlap. On the other hand, the ABC is rightly pointing out that the US has a cold, realistic calculation when it asks others to join. But it's not reciprocated. That is, Australians' reason for joining may be this broader picture. The United States just wants partners to give it that diplomatic and military cover. And I guess at the end of the day, and I hate to use that trite phrase, but the bottom line, to use another trite phrase, is what did they get out of it? Let me start with New Zealand. What did we get out of? We were there for about 12, 13 years. And what did New Zealand get out of their commitment to this coalition? It got 10 dead. It will undoubtedly get Afghan refugees because we're in the same predicament. of trying to bring back people who helped the New Zealanders and are now at risk of Taliban retaliation. We spent millions of dollars in aid and military assistance, and that's about it. That's about it. I mean, I would imagine that Afghan refugees will enrich the New Zealand social fabric, so I'm thankful for that. But what exactly did we get out of it? Did we get any more favor from the United States for joining this coalition? And by the way, the coalition of the willing in Iraq? The answer is no, nothing. The Australians invested even more. And what have they gotten out of it? 30 war dead, I believe it is, something along those lines. They have some of their elite soldiers are on trial for crimes against humanity. And
yeah, I was going to say, in both countries, there's a population now that is actually critical, even more than it was before, on the role of its own defence forces in Australia. But New Zealand is certainly in that as well, with respect to the Operation Burnham and the Commission of Inquiry that looked into all of the allegations of war crimes that occurred, arguably in that particular operation, that particular night against civilians. So, you know, there's a lot here, isn't it? The lot has been lost from the point of view of faith and believing that our governments and our defence forces work in our collective interests.
Exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, not that this is a reason not to do something, but Australia's involvement in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan brought terrorism to its shores. The domestic terrorist events in Australia that are linked to Islamicism were all in turn tied to Australian military adventurism in the Middle East and Central Asia. Now, again, I wouldn't use that as a reason not to go if there are other justifications for going, and there certainly were. But the point here is that, in a way, the Australians sullied themselves in order to curry favor with the United States. And again, they may have broader, you know, decades-long goals in mind as they try to become the Southern Hemisphere sub-hegemon, if you will. But that notwithstanding, they have certainly paid a price over the short term. And this brings up the other side of that twist that I talked about with regards to the United States and how its allies need to look at it. You mentioned it, but it's worth reaffirming. The United States, by any objective measure, is an unstable political system. It is now a fragile democracy. It has hyper-partisan politics that are often disloyal, that is, one side opposes the other just to try to remove it, to undermine it. It has serious problems with corruption and with incompetence at the highest levels of government, including the military commands, the Central Command that was responsible for both Iraq and Afghanistan. It turns out there are many problems with the command leadership in the Central Command, and they're not the only one. So their military elite have been exposed for their incompetence, and Afghanistan is a clear example of that. And then let's be honest, on January 6th, we saw an insurrection, people attempting to overturn a democratic election, a free and fair election, by force, by storming the U.S. Capitol. You can't get around this. If this occurred in Argentina, we'd say, oh, it's a basket republic, or, they're very civil. The fact is, the United States is not reliable domestically. What Biden says today could be overturned by Trump returning or one of his wannabes in four years. So, you know, the hard fact of the matter is, and this goes to that second image issue we've talked about in the past, the domestic sources of foreign policy. The United States is in no position to offer its allies consistent, stable, coherent leadership.
That's important, isn't it? That old adage about, you know, get your own backyard in order before you go striding around the community or something like that. Well, this is the same on the global stage, isn't it? If you are rocking at your foundation, then all sorts of things materialise from that. Instability, obviously the overt kind of expressions of chaos that we have seen around January this year. But it also, underneath the hood, Paul, let's have a look at that. And it's a part of the series of questions that we said at the beginning here. Are the United States' failures tied solely to incompetent leadership, or is there clearly apparent incompetence caused by those within the star general ranks of occupational forces? We've dealt with that in part. Or is this problem institutionalized now within a morphed alliance of incompetence from a broad base of institutions located within the United States security defense apparatus? So, you know, that the latter part, What can you unpack that and cast it off as irrelevant, or give it a priority that you believe it deserves?
No, I mean your questions are very salient. Let me start though with another foreign thing and then get to them specifically. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's multiple layers of problem here. Let me just say one thing though. This offers NATO an opportunity to rediscover it itself. Why do I say that? NATO was formed as a defensive alliance against the Soviet Union, the common threat posed by the Soviets to European nations in post-World War II, where they couldn't defend themselves, and so they invited the United States. That's why it's called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. When the Soviet Union fell, they lost their reason for being. You know, the whole point was to contain the Soviet Union, not to push it back, but to contain it so that it would not overrun what is now Western Europe. Absent the Soviet Union, they had no reason for being, but huge bureaucracies had built up. I mean, whole militaries had been built up, you know, under the rubric of NATO. And so they started looking for missions, and the United States offered them the new missions, which was regime change and nation building in unstable places far away from Europe. So they got into places like Libya. They got into places like Iraq and Syria. They got into Afghanistan. They started finding missions and redefining not the core purpose of NATO, but certainly the incidental purposes. And they got themselves in quagmires. Let's be very clear. Countries like Denmark and Norway spent a considerable amount of blood and treasure in ventures far away from their shores and which had no existential anything.
And this is despite, for example, Condoleezza Rice of the Bush administration openly pushing this this idea of regional response for regional problems. And yet we see all of these years after Condoleezza Rice and George W. Bush, et cetera, have left the White House, we still see it. Do you see that what we saw in Afghanistan, the chaos around the withdrawal, what we see inside the United States, where its institutions seem to be chaotic at best, like you have dealt to. Do you see that this is something that can be arrested? The United States wish to be relevant on the global stage. Do you see it being able to be contained? Is isolationism of the United States the answer, or is it one where we have a more multilateral level playing field amongst its security partners, where perhaps the United States doesn't necessarily enjoy the big seat at the top table all the time?
Well, Obama got pilloried because he said that the U.S. was going to lead from behind in Libya. And we understood, you and I, for example, understood what he meant. That the Libya, for example, Italy has long historical ties to Libya. The Europeans receive a lot of petroleum from Libya. The United States does not. So the idea was, let the Europeans take the lead when it comes to getting rid of Gaddafi and putting in a more Western-friendly regime. And the United States will play a support role. Well, that didn't play well at home because of all the chauvinists, particularly in the Republican Party, who were like, oh, look, we're cowarding out. We should be the leader of the world, blah, 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 blah. And that leads to a serious problem that I'll bring up in a second. The good news for NATO is now the Russians are back. The Russian bear is not only back, but it has annexed territory from the Ukraine. It has annexed territory from Georgia. It is an existential threat to the Europeans. So they've rediscovered their original mission.
So they've got purpose again.
And, well, they can do everything they used to as a defensive coalition with U.S. support. I would simply say it would be better for them to leave the U.S. as the support mechanism and not as the leader, because they're the ones on the front lines. You know, NATO now includes Poland. We must remember Russia warned about allowing any frontline state that shares a border with Mother Russia into NATO. They said, the Russians said, that's a line that you will not cross. Well, NATO went ahead and did. And we see the consequences of that. The Russians have decided we are going to move our borders outwards in those countries that may be considering NATO membership. Well, guess what? Ukraine is next in line for an invitation into NATO, and Moscow has pretty much precluded that. So I think
Have a look at this too. This is along that lines, just very briefly. This is foreignaffairs.com, so based in the United States, of course, and it's talking about exactly this point from the point of view of a post-American Central Asia, how the region is adapting to the US defeat in Afghanistan. Its main points are along this line, similar to yours here, Paul. It's saying that the Taliban victory in Afghanistan was unleashed a wave of anger at United States President Joe Biden, but it goes beyond that. It's saying what the critics miss, however, is that Central Asia is no longer the anarchic place that it was 20 years ago when the Taliban once ruled. And it's saying that there are many other influences now, not just from the point of view of security or defense solutions to such perceived problems, being beyond the United States. It's talking about, and you have in previous episodes as well, the Chinese influence, the Russian backlash of enduring US military presence, as it puts it. It talks about NATO. All of these issues, Paul, are starting to actually get debated within perhaps the deeper analytical kind of areas of United States press, as opposed to the mainstream public consumption parts of the media. With that in mind, do you believe that the United States will recognize that this at this point, at this juncture, it is best to work with its allies on a level playing field instead of leading from the front? Or once again, going back to that question, do you believe it will retreat back and take a more partnership position on such big issues as you're identifying there with the satellite states, the former Soviet satellite states, for example, of controlled states of Poland, Ukraine, etc., and how NATO responds to the Russian influence and want in that region?
Well, we have to think about it this way, that you have two sides to the leadership coin, both in Europe and in the United States. On the one hand, you have the political leadership. And the political leadership may have to make the decision in the first instance that they're going to reorient their approaches to international security. In the case of the European members of NATO, whether or not they will continue to support the United States in every military venture that it undertakes overseas. And I would say that the politicians, not all of them are of the caliber of Angela Merkel, but that the politicians in Europe clearly see that this is, to continue to do so would be folly. There may be diplomatic reasons, there may be economic reasons, and if so, they can be factored into the mix of whether or not to support a U.S. military venture. But the politicians, I think, because their politics, to my mind, are more honest than those in the United States for the most part, will make determinations about their own national interests. On the other hand, you have military bureaucracies that have been built up over the last 20 years with the sole purpose of reproducing this regime change nation-building logic along the lines proposed by the United States military. And it will take a very courageous general to stand up in, let's say, the British military. You know, in fact, I'll use the British because they have suffered many losses in Afghanistan for no real purpose. It would take a very courageous general to say, we've got to stop following the United States around. Our interests overlap and dovetail with those of the U.S. In many instances, we have historical ties together, but the world is different for us than it is for them, because we don't exist in the middle of the United States. So that would be
a public response. Do you think that discussion is taking place within the defense elite in the UK behind the scenes at the moment?
I believe it does. I think the conversations, again, there too, are more honest. I mean, there's still a lot of, I don't want to call them reactionaries because, and I've actually got friends who have come out, some are actually still in the British Army Reserves, who fought in Afghanistan. They're not happy campers because they know what we're talking about. I mean, they know that it was futile. They lost, you know, they lost buddies to the Taliban. They don't want to hear that it's all over. But in their hearts of hearts, they know that they shouldn't send their successors to similarly futile ventures. You know, if you're going to be honest with yourself as a soldier or former soldier, spare the next generation of soldiers the grief that you went through. You know, make it an honorable cause. Make it a cause that everybody will understand 20 years down the road. See, everybody was cheerleading in 2002. 2003. Then the U.S. invaded Iraq. Things went sideways from there. And by 2012, the majority of publics outside of the United States no longer supported these war ventures. The U.S. continued on because of the fake patriotism and all that hype. But the rest of the world were, you know, pretty much the publics were, what exactly are we doing there? So it's a time for a change. Now, here's the problem. In the United States, you have a political leadership that is wagged by the tail known as the partisan media. The part, and again, this is mostly the right-wing media, is a warmongering media because they're not going to send their sons and daughters. The squawking people that we see on cable TV are cowards who would have never served their country, yet they frame the debate about almost everything. And then the left side, such as it is, the Democrats, they wind up playing defense and catch up, trying to alter the terms of debate with inside that right-wing framing. And so you have a political class that is increasingly very venal, a hyper-partisan, quite corrupt, who will say anything to undermine the opponent. And that, unfortunately, would not be consequential if the military leadership were the people of integrity that George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower were back in the day. But what's happened with the U.S. military leadership since the 1980s is that military leaders are promoted because of length of service and ticking the right boxes in terms of the commands that they're assigned to on their way up, not because of their battlefield prowess. And here's the bottom line is this, and you can see it, I hate to say, in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And again, I don't mean to single him out because he is yet another of one of these army generals. This actually, because it's the central command, it's an army-centric command. Why? Because the central command is a land-based command, unlike, for example, the Pacific Command, which is a Navy, has a naval leadership, is a maritime space, and so forth. Now, here's the problem. The U.S. has engaged, again, by choice, in a series of land wars in the Middle East and Central Asia over the last 20 years, and it has had to retreat from all of them. It has not won a single one. The leaders of those failed military ventures are members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and are major commanders in the U.S. military today. Why did they get as high as they did? Well, they checked the right boxes, and at some points in their career, before they made flag rank, they showed tactical acumen. That is to say, as lieutenants, captains, and majors involved in skirmishes and whatnot, they showed agility, They showed leadership. They showed courage. They showed the things you want to see in a young military officer. But when they made flag rank, when they put that first star on, they became politicians and they became risk adverse. And here is the irony. The United States prevailed tactically. That is, it defeated the enemy on the ground pretty much every time it engaged the enemy. The trouble is, it had no strategic vision of what the heck it was doing when it was fighting the enemy. The enemy were Iraqis in Iraq. The enemy were Afghans in Afghanistan. The enemy were Libyans in Libya. No one ever figured out we're fighting on their homeland. What is the end goal here? Because the U.S. military subscribes to something called effects-based warfare. You have a goal you want to achieve, not just defeat the enemy, but, oh, we're going to have a modern society, we're going to have a secular society, women are going to be free, all that. Here's how we achieve it militarily. Quite frankly, that's nuts in my mind. There is an intervening variable known as the enemy who might, you know, he just might interfere with your plans. But the point is, they went in and did this. They failed miserably at a strategic level for all their tactical successes. And they are the leadership of the U.S. military today. Let's just say the common characteristic of a lot of the 3 and 4 stars in the U.S. military today is incompetence and being promoted above their station. They're there because of length of time served. And it's not just the Army. The Navy, we know that the 3rd Fleet based out of Pearl Harbor, but particularly the forward deployed component in Okinawa, have had tremendous problems. Let's face it, 3 boat crashes in the space of 5 years, the corruption scandal, the Fat Leonard corruption scandal, where 30 flag rank officers were caught up being bribed with hookers, money and real estate. I mean, there are serious problems in the U.S. military that need to be rectified because these guys don't have the moral authority to stand up to a reckless president like Donald Trump or say to a feckless president like Joe Biden, look at your idea that the United States is going back to the head of the table, that this liberal internationalism that you and I, Selwyn, talked about last week, that somehow we're going to recover this and restore the U.S. as the world's global policeman. Sorry, but no, that is not happening. We have to adjust to a world in which we're just another great power jockeying for position with some very smart but antagonistic players on the world scene, such as the Chinese, such as the Russians, and smaller players as well. Because you can say a lot of... You can say a lot of things about the North Koreans, but those guys are crazy like foxes, and pretty much under every president over the last 30-some-odd years, they've been able to outwit them while they continue to build their nuclear arsenal. So,
Paul,
Let me just conclude by saying all of this is to say that be it those of us here in New Zealand, or the NATO allies in Europe need to take a long, hard look at the United States as a security partner, no matter whether or not it continues to offer guarantees and say it's back after a 4-year interregnum of neo-isolationism under Trump, and decide for themselves based on their own strategic interests whether they want to continue the U.S.'s lead when it comes to military adventurism abroad.
Paul, is what you've detailed there, and it spans a lot of material, obviously, is that a definition, an explanation, and an answer to that question that we put just before? Is this problem institutionalized within a morphed alliance of incompetence from a broad base of institutions located within the United States security defense apparatus? There's so much that you've just described there that would cause any reasonably minded person to obviously be concerned in the extreme. If that is encompassed within that definition of the question, then the globe has a major problem unless the order changes clearly. And it may be medium term, it may be long term. But let's just go to this, that we'll pick up rather than get a response. We've got here, for example, in New Zealand, a well-known investigative journalist here who's written considerably on the Afghanistan situation and wars in general, Nikki Hager. And he put out overnight, this morning it was published on the spin-off in New Zealand here. And he makes a point here. And where he's talking about after 20 largely wasted years in Afghanistan. And there's comparison points to what you've written, spoken about today, Paul. Nikki Hager puts, but this is not good enough. Yes, is this good enough? Yes, New Zealand personnel, defence personnel, went to Afghanistan believing it was to make life better for the people of Afghanistan. But the whole mission was deeply flawed from the beginning, no fault of the rank and file soldiers, and increasingly doomed to fail. We owe it to everyone concerned to face up to that fact. Do you believe, Paul, that when the security partners like New Zealand, Australia, the United Kingdom, Canada, the NATO Alliance members, when they start finger pointing toward the United States, do you feel that they are getting off the hook somewhat by not looking at their own involvement, their own flawed commitments to such wars? And do you see on the back of that some sort of positive solution that could come out of all of this mess?
Well, I think that the situation here in Australia is slightly different than that of the United States. I'll address our situation first. I wouldn't mind if the NZDF, the New Zealand Defense Forces, and the ADF, the Australian Defense Forces, conducted quiet in-house reviews of their command leadership in these foreign ventures. Because they went along, we know from the reporting in the field and the very good work done by the likes of Nikki Hager, who you just mentioned, and the phenomenal John Stevenson when it comes to war matters in this particular field, that they wanted to be like the Americans. They wanted to be like the big army. They wanted to play like the big army. And they depended on the big army for air support, for intelligence, all sorts of things. I think that the NZDF and the ADF need to look at themselves and look at the commanders who wanted to be like the big army. Because again, their strategic interests are different. Again, the Australians may want to eventually be part of that big army. If so, just say so. And your public will be the judge of whether that's, you know, a good move or not. I don't care if they do it quietly, so long as they do it. Because the record so far is they will lie. They will cover up. They will whitewash. We saw it in the Operation Burnham inquiry, which for those viewers who do not know, was an inquiry into whether or not New Zealand troops committed war crimes in Afghanistan. I mean, that's how heavy it got. Now, Selwyn, this is different than in the United States. And the reason for this, for it is this. The United States public, for all its flaws, and there's plenty of them, are much more attuned to military things than we are here in New Zealand or even the Australians. I don't want to say that it's a warmongering society. I have lots of pacifist friends in the States on the left side of my friendship circles. But it's a warmongering society. It lives vicariously off of kicking rear and taking names. The whole language and nomenclature of sports and culture is militaristic. So they pay a lot more attention. And because of that, they need to be manipulated in a very different way. You know, whitewashing and stonewalling won't do it. And so what we see is this, Selwyn. The military commentators that we see on cable news, on all of the news channels, right and left, are the architects of the defeats in Middle East and Central Asia. It's the retired generals, the guys who came out of the Central Command, the guys who came out of the European Command, who led us into these quagmires, are now acting as pundits. And what they're doing is they're going partisan. It's either Trump's fault or it's Biden's fault. And they're absolving themselves of any complicity, much less blame, in the unfolding debacle that was Afghanistan. But let's remember, Iraq isn't going too well either, and Libya is in chaos. In fact, the leading foreign actor in Libya are the Russians. So we have a problem in the United States where, just like there's that revolving door between lobbyists and Congress people and what have you, there is a revolving door between former generals, defense contractors, the military industrial complex, and then the media, where these guys circulate. And what they basically do is they feed into the partisan arguments of the day, and they don't recognize the institutional mistakes, the institutional setup that leads to these mistakes. And they basically try to cover their tracks by admitting no fault in the planning, organization, and execution of not only the battle plans, but the sort of, again, effects-based modeling that led them to intervene in the first place and has now led to a situation where the U.S. is clearly seen as unreliable, and for the most aggressive of its adversaries, is clearly seen as a paper tiger in decline.
If we, in concluding this episode, Paul, if we drew a line in the sand and all of what we've described today and analyzed is on one side, and we step over that line into the new, and I'm not talking idealistically here, I'm talking realistically, what would you like to see next from the point of view of the United States and how it handles its affairs from this line in the sand onward?
Well, it may be wishful thinking, but you said it earlier, they got to get their own house in order. And that means bringing to justice politicians who participated in January 6th, members of the past administration for many acts of malfeasance, including using public office for personal gain. I mean, the U.S. needs to restore itself as a nation ruled by law rather than by the whims of people, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. The other thing is, the good news is I spend a lot of time reading military literature, strategic literature, mostly U.S.-centric, and there are enough retired people with stars, so generals and whatnot, who were honest and competent and didn't get 4 stars because they were honest and competent. And then a lot of disaffected junior officers, but including field grade are colonels and lieutenant colonels, who are like, you know, this is not good. You know, we went from a country that had about, at its max, 10,000 special forces troops, to now a country that has 150,000. If there's 150,000, what's so special about them? I mean, what exactly, you know, have we done with this? Well, that's because they got into the counterinsurgency game and they're confusing special operators with the regular warfare specialists. And that's a story for another day. The point simply is, there are enough live minds out there in the United States who see the need for institutional reform within the military. You notice that I didn't mention the Marines. It's because the Marines acquit themselves well on the leadership scale. We'll give them credit for that. And maybe the Marines will prove to be a model. One thing, we won't do it today, but perhaps in a future episode, we'll talk about that pivot to Asia. And the reason I think this will follow from our conversation today is that if the United States pivots towards Asian-based scenarios, they are going to be air and naval warfare dominant. If they're air and warfare dominant, the so-called marshals of retreat that were the leaders of the Central Army-centric command will no longer be part of the equation. It will be Air Force officers, naval officers, who will be leading the U.S. approach to the PRC, but also, more importantly, their approach to U.S. allies in the region, including Australia, New Zealand, but places like Singapore Indonesia, the Philippines. I mean, there's a lot of military diplomacy that can be done there. And perhaps with a change of theater, there can be a change of strategic vision, one that doesn't just focus on tactical victories and focuses on the bigger picture about how is this going to look 20 years down the road. And if we do that, then perhaps some good will have come of this, because the strategic culture of the United States ultimately is the root cause for the debacles that we see today.
And unless that's corrected, then it would also follow from the experiences of the last 20 years that it would be folly, perhaps, to engage and allow that kind of leadership to invade this region without question. And on that point, I'll bring people, they can keep this conversation going on demand, and also, for example, on Facebook, there is a number of links that are there that raise the questions of whether or not countries should be challenging the United States' positions of dominance within NATO at this juncture, et cetera, et cetera. So those are beneath the live streams. And thank you to our audience, and in particular Liz Hughes, who's put some of those links there for people's interests. We will return again this time next week. That is midday Thursday New Zealand Standard Time, and that equates to around 8 p.m. In the United States on the Eastern Daylight Saving Time band. So until that time next week, we encourage you all to look forward to our program as we return then. Until that time, thank you, take care, goodbye.